Today, let's talk about the other shepherd.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
This is a scripture show, we call them, and we're doing the Psalms, because I'm in the Psalms, and Psalm 49 is the Psalm today, almost a third of the way through the Psalms in my excursion, doing each Psalm, and just trying to grasp what the actual message in the Psalm is. And Psalm 49 has some unique elements to it. I have spent my life, obviously, I've read the Psalms many times through, just like you've probably used them devotionally. You know, you've done readings through the scriptures where you read something from the law and something from the prophets and something from the New Testament and then something from wisdom literature. And so you've probably read through the Psalms as many times as I have. And honestly, Psalm 49 has an image in it, a metaphor that I have just completely skirted by. I've seen similar ideas in other parts of scripture, but they were so radical. They were in these offensive prophetic utterances, things like that, that I didn't take them in the same way they come in this passage. And so I think there is a, I think there's something to be gained, even in our understanding of what Jesus is actually teaching, what the New Testament teaches us in some of its passages, that I had just neglected because I didn't pay attention to some of the imagery in this psalm. So I'm looking forward to this one. So Psalm 49, I'm going to read it to you. It's 20 verses, 21 if you take it in the Hebrew way, as if the superscript is one of the verses. And it is another of these psalms from the sons of Korah, the ones who are writing the worship for sort of the liturgy for the congregants who would come to the temple, the tabernacle at first, then the temple, and then ultimately the synagogue meetings and so on. The sons of Korah were the ones who were writing these songs. So it's formal in that sense. It's designed for congregational worship together, to sing together. So this one is particularly interesting because of how, well, you'll see. It brings in some of the elements that we would expect to find in Ecclesiastes, for instance, in a fairly powerful way. So here's how the psalm goes. To the choir master, a psalm of the sons of Korah. Hear this, all peoples. Give ear, all inhabitants of the world, both low and high, rich and poor together. My mouth shall speak wisdom. The meditation of my heart shall be understanding. I will incline my ear to a proverb. I will solve my riddle to the music of the lyre. All of that introductory. Now verse 5, we begin. Why should I fear in times of trouble when the iniquity of those who cheat me surrounds me, those who trust in their wealth and boast of the abundance of their riches? Truly, no man can ransom another or give to God the price of his life, for the ransom of their life is costly and can never suffice that he should live on forever and never see the pit. For he sees that even the wise die, the fool and the stupid alike must perish and leave their wealth to others. Their graves are their homes forever, their dwelling places to all generations, though they call lands by their own names. Man in his pomp will not remain. He is like the beasts that perish. And if you think that that language is offensive, it's going to be repeated. So be double offended. This is the path of those who have foolish confidence. Yet after them, people approve of their boasts, Selah. Like sheep, they are appointed for Sheol. death shall be their shepherd, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning. Their form shall be consumed in Sheol with no place to dwell. But God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me, Selah. Be not afraid when a man becomes rich, when the glory of his house increases, for when he dies, he will carry nothing away. His glory will not go down after him. For though while he lives, he counts himself blessed, and though you get praise when you do well for yourself, his soul will go to the generation of his fathers, who will never again see light. Man in his pomp, yet without understanding, is like the beasts that perish. So before we start into actually going through the psalm in more detail, let me just point out a couple of things that sort of demand attention for grasping the message in this psalm. First of all, right in the middle of the psalm, there are a couple of verses, a couple of passages that are longer, that are more significant. The line length sort of draws them out, draws attention to them. There are actually three verses like this, verses in the way they're given to us in the English Bible. It's verses 10 and 11, and then verse 14. And the message they carry is obvious, and it's at the heart of the psalm again. Verse 10, for he sees that even the wise die. The fool and the stupid alike must perish and leave their wealth to others. In the next verse, which is also just as long, their graves are their homes forever, their dwelling places to all generations, even though they had called lands by their own names. Those two verses sort of set a tone for what this psalm is dealing with, the universal nature of death. It's at the center of it. And it goes beyond that into verse 14, like sheep. And this is not only the central metaphor in the psalm, or at least the most important or stark metaphor in the psalm, but also another one of these really long lines that sort of demands attention. Like sheep, they are appointed for Sheol. Death shall be their shepherd, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning. Their form shall be consumed in Sheol with no place to dwell. Those three verses are a different type of rhythm. They have a different length altogether than the rest of the psalm. All the other verses are different. So they demand our attention. The second thing is right in the middle of that, the only line that's so clearly repeated, verse 12, which goes with verse 20. Man in verse 12, and they are different. It's important they're different for a reason that we'll talk about. But in verse 12, it is, man in his pomp will not remain. He is like the beasts that perish. And then the last verse, which demands attention just by being the last verse, repeats that line. Man in his pomp, but then it changes from simply an iteration of the same statement, man will not remain, he's like the beasts that perish. It changes from that to this. Man in his pomp, yet without understanding, is like the beasts that perish. And there's some reason that he's made that change that we'll talk about as we're going through it. And this is a normal thing that happens in poetry or in any kind of good writing. If an author is repeating a line, which would often happen, the very first line and the last lines sounding exactly the same, but then what you've learned in the middle changes how you understand it by the time you read the last line. This is why you would do it, right? And the same thing happens here. You say it once in the middle of the psalm to make the point one way, and then you say it at the end of the psalm to make a point that now you understand because you've read through the whole psalm and you grasp what hadn't been grasped before. So the universal nature of death is obviously sort of thematic in the elements that are going into this psalm, into writing this song or poem for Israel to sing corporately together. And yet, as the sons of Korah write it, for Israel to celebrate together in the tabernacle, temple, or wherever they are, it's not just written to them. As they sing the words, they're asking all the nations of the earth to hear it, because the psalm itself obviously is appealing to something that goes beyond this one individual culture. So the first four verses, and some of the Psalms are this way, especially some of the ones from the sons of Korah, we had this conversation about one not too long ago where the first verse was really attached to the superscript. It was still the psalmist saying, my pen is ready to write. I'm doing this because I want you to hear this message. And so it's still the author saying, here's what I want you to know about me as you're going into this psalm. And so this one is similar, but it's sort of the whole congregation together joining in the message that this psalm conveys to say in the very first verse, hear this, all peoples. And this the first four verses don't say anything about death. They don't talk about what it is that makes this so universally appealing or important. They're just making the appeal. Hey, this is not just for us. We're singing this because it applies to everyone, everywhere, for all time. And so the first four verses I take just to be introductory in a strong sense, like they're a preface to the actual psalm, which begins in verse 5, or to the content of the psalm that begins in verse 5. So the first four verses, hear this, all peoples, give ear, all inhabitants of the world, both low and high, rich and poor together, my mouth shall speak wisdom. The meditation of my heart shall be understanding. I will bend my ear, incline my ear to hear, to listen to wisdom, to a proverb, a wise saying. I will solve my riddle, the ESV translates it, to the music of the lyre. And, you know, the really creative language and lyric that leaves a person to figure out what's supposed to be going on with it. That's the idea of the riddle here. It's the same kind of thing that Samson does, you know, with creating a riddle for the people who had meddled with his wife or the wife he was going to have. So the point here is, I will solve my riddle to the music of the lyre is an invitation for people to listen to the extreme wisdom that's present in this psalm that gives us a clarity about life that we normally don't see. So the first four verses actually do make a point for the psalm that invites us into the rest of it, to the deep, to the real content of the psalm, by saying to us, the wisdom that we're going to be sharing with you now is constant. It's universal. It applies to everyone, everywhere, for all time. So eternal, universal application. So that's why it says all peoples in verse 1, all inhabitants of the world in verse 1. In verse 2, low and high, rich and poor. And then in verses 3 and 4, it's saying, here's what applies to everyone, everywhere, for all time, wisdom, understanding. A proverb, when it's crafted into this really creative sense, like a riddle in this case, then it's worth anyone hearing what's being shared. There are cultural differences that are important that make it almost impossible for people from different cultures to communicate. And there's a whole way of studying that that relates the idea that cultures actually have an incommensurability to them, making it impossible to cross the line between cultures or to translate anything accurately, because what a person really means by it is slightly different. You never really grasp the full depth of, you know, and so on. And I understand that. I actually think it's important to grasp it. When I traveled to India, which I'm not some, you know, jet hopping world traveler. But I did go to India back in 2005 and then again in 2007 or 2008. I can't remember the exact years. But I got to go with a really fun group, a great group of medical professionals. So some doctors, nurses were going over to provide medical care for a lot of people who needed it in the different areas of India we were going to travel to. And they wanted someone to come to connect with the pastors who were there. And, you know, like you do on a lot of these trips, do some theological training, which, you know, almost anybody with some theological training will do. You know, we love the opportunity to do that. And so I got to go with this group to India, and I got to know my translator really well, and he was sort of a leader among other pastors who were in the area, in the different areas that we went, but in one area in particular. And in his home area, he said he really wanted me to spend an evening or two doing some marital counseling with a couple of families that he really wanted to help. And I told him, I would love to do it. I would love the opportunity to help that way. I had done a lot of pastoral counseling up to that point in my ministry. And so I felt perfectly comfortable at the time doing marriage counseling and had some real success in it here. But I said to him, I would love to do that, but I don't know your culture well enough to do that kind of counseling with your people. I wouldn't even know how to interpret what's a symptom of a problem and what's being expressed as something that would be normative in the relationships that your families would have. I can share with you my understanding of how to help couples accomplish what they need to do to be able to stay together and have a successful marriage, and then you can probably work with them to help them in some of those counseling needs, but I just don't understand your culture and the nature of marriage and your culture well enough to do that counseling. And I still, to this day, think that was the right decision to make. And we did have a conversation about it, and I hope he was able to help those families. And we went back a couple of times, so I suspect he did. Anyway, the point is, I recognize the gravity of cultural differences. Anybody who's traveled seriously to other cultures recognizes how steep the division is, how deep that is, the division is, the chasm is between truly distinct cultures. There are ways in which the connection between two cultures can be almost impossible. I get that. But I also know that you can exaggerate that because there are some universals between cultures. There's no doubt. And I mean, everybody eats. Everybody has to drink. Everybody understands. Do you know what the most common word in the world is? Not the most common term, not the most common idea expressed with different words. I mean, literally the word. You know, you pronounce it this way, you spell it this way, it's this word. And everybody in the world knows it the same way. Not everybody, but more people than any other word. Now, I can't prove that this is true, but where I've looked, this is the answer. And it seems to be the answer in several places, so I'm going to go with it. But and it makes perfect sense when you hear it. The most common word in the world, said the same way by everybody. You know what it is? Okay. That's the word. Okay. Everybody says it the same way. And everywhere I've been, including India and Russia and where people are speaking Spanish, everywhere I've been, everybody says okay. Every kid I talked to had no idea what I was saying. And they would say, okay. You know, they still, and by that, they were saying, yeah, I'll go along with you, I assume. They were just saying, yeah, it's okay that you're doing that. It means the same thing everywhere. I have no idea why that term became so universal. No idea. But it is universal. There are things that are even more universal than that, because there are certainly some places where people don't know the word okay. I'm sure we can find somewhere in the world that that's the case. But there's nowhere in the world people don't need to eat. Nowhere that the sky is not higher than the ground and that water isn't something that's essential to life. And the reality is there's nowhere you can go that people don't die. It's universal. There are universals that tie us together. And the opening to this psalm is the psalmist's invitation for us to recognize that what he's going to teach us isn't bound to Israel, isn't unique to the people of God and what they've learned. It's something everyone, everywhere should know, and that would give us a better footing for how we live in this life. So now we're going to take it in three big pieces, and they're sort of automatically divided by the imagery itself and also by the language, and as I mentioned to you a moment ago, by those really long lines that are in verses 10, 11, and 14 surrounding the idea that man and his pomp will not remain, and he's like the beasts that perish, and then he talks about the beasts after that. That whole section seems to be, in one sense, that's verses 10 through 14, it seems to be in support of verses 5 through 9, where we learn something about wisdom and what it does for us, but it's a certain kind of wisdom. It's the wisdom we have in this world. We'll talk about it in a moment. And so in one sense, verses 10 through 14 sort of supports that, but then verses 10 through 14 also lead into a different kind of wisdom, a way of understanding it, in verses 15 through 20. So we're going to sort, and that's the end of the psalm. So what we're really doing now is taking verses 5 through 20 as the bulk, the content of the psalm, and taking the first part of that and the last part of that as sort of a contrasting way to understand the world based on what we learned in the middle of it in verses 10 through 14. So let's take the first part of it, the wisdom we already have, the things we already know about the world, and the things that need to be corrected in us. So starting in verse 5, our fear. Verse 5, why should I fear in times of trouble when the iniquity of those who cheat me surrounds me? So this is being spoken by somebody who's already worked through the whole idea. He knows there's something even in the way I live in this world that should already tell me that my fear is misplaced when what I fear are those who are using their power in this world to oppress me. I should know better than to be afraid of them in some way. This is what he's communicating. So in verse 5, why should I fear in times of trouble when the iniquity of those who cheat me surrounds me? Who am I talking about? Those who trust in their wealth in verse 6, those who boast of the abundance of their riches. Why should I fear those people? Well, why do we fear those people? And then what does that fear look like? That's what he begins to address in verse 7. So he says in verse 7, truly no man can ransom another or give to God the price of his life. So clearly he's taken a couple of steps forward and said, you know, my fear was misplaced because they can't ransom their own life from God. No man can ransom, but he doesn't say their own life. And this is unique. It's odd. In this section, in verses 5 through 9, he's gone from the idea that I fear people who are powerful enough to hurt me to saying that I shouldn't trust them to deliver me from the things that I actually fear. That's a weird shift. I mean, it's not too weird once you understand the context of it, but it feels a little off. What I would have expected him to say is, why be afraid of them? They're not powerful enough to harm you. He doesn't say that. He says, why be afraid of them? They're not powerful enough to help you. Did you catch the twist? It's not they're not powerful enough to hurt you. It's that they're not powerful enough to help you. So why are you afraid of them? Truly no man, he says in verse 7, can ransom another or give to God the price of his life. For the ransom of their life is costly and can never suffice that he should live on forever and never see the pit. There's a part of what's built into that language that is saying they can't save themselves from the pit, but there's a part of that language that says they're not saving anyone else from the pit either. And so in verses 5 through 9, the focus is, as we talk about this, something about the way the powerful are unable to rescue others, including us. In the end of the psalm, in verses 16 through 19, just so the imagery is clear, it's not about them not rescuing us. It's about them not being able to rescue themselves. And it's just about that. So something's changed by the time we get to verses 16 through 19. We'll get to that when we get to it. But in verses 5 through 9, what is it that happened with us? And what happened was we were fearing. So I'm talking not now the language of verse 5, but the narrative that underlies this language, right? The poet is saying, why was I so afraid of them? They can't save other people. Why was I... And the narrative that's lying under that is that I find these people who have so much power, and in this psalm, that's equated with wealth. It can take all kinds of forms, but whatever the form is, they have all kinds of power, military power, political power, wealth power, whatever it is, prestige, anything. But they have this power, and I'm afraid of them, but what that turned into was trying to get close to them. Oh, well, they have power, they're going to hurt me, so I'll get on their side, and then I'll be on the safe side, because they're the ones that hurt people. We'll be on the side that hurts people. I don't want to be on the side that's getting hurt. You know, if you got to be on one side or the other, be on the side wearing the shoes. Don't be on the side underneath the soles of their feet, right? So I'm going to go on that side. That's kind of how we live in this world. And that's what wisdom in this life does. And let me put it this way. That's what wisdom, when you bracket it, when you say, how am I going to live in the only world we've encountered, the one that's inside the brackets of birth and death, where that's the only world I've lived in, right? I was born into this world, so I got to know things, got to see things, learned how the world works. This is how I understand it. And I haven't seen anything on the other side. I mean, the people who go to the other side leave. I don't encounter them at all. They're in a grave somewhere. So I deal with a world within these brackets, and within these brackets, those are the people who have money. And when you base your wisdom on a world that's bracketed by birth and death, then you end up tying fear, and I'm going to use the word favor, together. But it really turns into fear and fawning. I've made jokes about this. I get to serve as president of Criswell College. I get to know a lot of people who have a lot of resources and have chosen to use those resources to just try to help. They're just trying to make a difference in the world. And so they're giving money away. You know, they're helping people in all kinds of ways. And I'm blessed in having met a lot of people who are not guilty of what I'm about to describe to you. I've also been able to meet a lot of people who are guilty of what I'm about to describe to you. And it applies to every kind of person. It doesn't matter whether the power has to do with money or if it has to do with being a boss or an employer. I've seen it in myself as a president. It doesn't matter how a person has power. There is a thing that I've referred to as wealth blindness, but it's really just power blindness. That when a person is in a position of power over someone else, it's hard for that other person to tell them the truth, you know? So they'll say, you know, the person in power will say, oh, you know, I've got this idea. And everybody listening to them is like, oh, that's a brilliant idea. Can I have some of your money? And they can't get honest feedback. I think it's one of the reasons that I'm blessed to have a good relationship with some of the people that I do know who are in positions of power, because they appreciate that I give them honest feedback. It's the reason a lot of people don't necessarily like my company that much. I understand that too. I don't blame you for that. But getting honest feedback when you're in a position of power is difficult to do. And the reason it's difficult is not their fault. It's not the powerful person's fault. It's our fault because we want to just earn their favor somehow. Oh yeah. You see how agreeable I am? Can I just get you to keep that umbrella of power over me? So that I can be included in the good side of it. That's us. And our tendency, when we bracket our perspective of the world by those endpoints of birth at the beginning and death at the very end of life, if that's all we see is what's inside those brackets, then that's the world we're going to live in. How do I curry favor? How do I end up in the right place? And the psalmist's point here, the sons of Korah, as they write this song for us, are saying, why do we live in that kind of fear? The people that we're fawning after, the people that we're seeking favor from, they don't have the power to rescue our lives or even their own. They're going to see the same catastrophe we see, and you should know that by the very fact that they're trying with their power to accomplish what their power can't do, which is overcome death itself, overcome the brackets that we're using to gain the wisdom, which we ought to recognize is false by the very brackets that we've put around it. That idea that the wisdom that brackets the world with birth and death ties together that kind of fear with currying favor is the same idea that Jesus is coming to, and I don't know if in this passage in Matthew he's actually alluding to or echoing this psalm, or if it's less direct even than that. I don't know. But it's the idea is so similar. And in Matthew 10, when Jesus is sending out the disciples, and they're going into the villages and doing all these things, and he talks about the ones who will persecute them and how to respond to that. It's a different thing, but their power is the ability to persecute these. And David's dealing with those who are cheating him, who are persecuting him in some way. In that context, though, of persecution in Matthew 10, Jesus puts it this way, do not fear, so why should I fear these people? Jesus says, do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Don't fear those who are powerful within the brackets of birth and death. They don't have any power outside those brackets. Their power ends with the brackets. So don't fear those who kill the body but can't kill the soul. Rather, fear him who operates outside of those brackets, who can destroy both soul and body in hell. And it's clear Jesus is not speaking to his disciples and saying, you ought to be afraid of a lot more than that. You ought to be afraid because you're about to lose your souls. He's not saying that. These are the disciples he's sending out with his message. He's saying to them, you can trust the one who can bring judgment on them. And so he's separating the idea of eternal judgment from our fear of this temporal judgment that we face in the world because we don't have the power that they have. And if you want to look at it on the opposite side, the other side of the coin from fear, where it comes back to our seeking to curry favor from someone who has that kind of power, It's in James 2. You know, maybe the first epistle, almost certainly the first epistle, written after the resurrection of Jesus to the church, to the early church. And in that one, he's having to deal with the fact that the people who are being persecuted by the powerful and wealthy are seeking their favor in their congregation. Oh, let's treat them well. You know the passage. I'm going to read it to you, James 2, because it fits exactly what the psalmist is saying here. My brothers, show no partiality as you hold the faith in our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory. He's the one who's glorious. That's why he says it there. Because if a man wearing a gold ring and fine clothing comes into your assembly, and some poor man in shabby clothing also comes in, and if you pay attention to the one who wears the fine clothing and you say, oh, you sit here in a good place, while you say to the poor man, just stand over there. Or sit down here under my feet. Have you not then made distinctions among yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts? Listen, my beloved brothers. Hasn't God chosen those who are poor in the world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which he promised to those who love him? But you've dishonored the poor man. Aren't the rich the very ones who are oppressing you? Aren't they the ones who are dragging you into court? But you see what that means to us. In this world, because we see this world bracketed by birth and death, when they oppress us or they drag us into court, we say, how do we get on their side? How do we earn their favor? And the psalmist is saying, and Jesus said, and James is saying, don't do that. Don't exercise a wisdom that's bracketed by birth and death. And then he goes on to say, and after all, they're the ones who are blaspheming the honorable name by which you are actually called. He's the Lord of glory. He's the one who gives honor, not these who have power in this world. It's really hard for us to do that because when you're in this world's trouble is like the only thing you can see. It's just almost impossible to get past it. And so the psalmist has made the point that wisdom, so this is the first part of the invitation. We should recognize this. The fact that people are aggrandizing that power is because they're trying to overcome something we know they can't overcome. The grave constantly declares they can't overcome it. And so they're going to end up in the wrong place no matter what they do with it. There are a bunch of different ways I can say this, but I'll say it this way. I love riding a bike. I enjoy it. I get good exercise out of it. I love the first 5 miles of my 10-mile rides, and that makes it worth doing the exercise. But I'm not great at it. So if I'm riding well, and I ride pretty consistently, so I'll ride probably 5 days this week. I ride 18 miles an hour. That's my pace. I mean, when it's flat and the wind's not against me and, you know, my little toe's not hurting, whatever. But if everything's going right, 18 miles an hour is what I'm going to do. I go to a bike shop now and I ride a cyclocross bike. It's like a hybrid bike with drop bars. That makes me sound cool, but I'm not. I don't even use the drop bars, but it makes it look like I could go faster if I wanted. The point is, I ride about 18 miles an hour. That's about it. And so I go to a bike shop. They want to sell me a bike. It's like $10,000. You know, the less resistance. Look, you can hold it up with two fingers, and it's made of carbon fiber, the whole thing. And you can add special components, and it's even lighter. You know, it actually floats, and you have to hold it down when you sit on it, whatever. And it's so light, it'll give you. And I could buy that bike, and I can guarantee you I would ride 18 miles an hour on that bike as well. I mean, it's just, I ride a bike at 18 miles an hour. And I see lots of people who spend the money on the extra bike, and they ride just like I do. I don't mean they ride the same speed. There are lots of them who ride faster than I do. Lots of them ride slower than I do. But regardless of what it is, they're just going to ride the pace they ride. And you can do we do everything in this life. I mean, we build a bigger house. We buy bigger land, more land. We plant better crops. We build an industry. We get our name on buildings. We do everything we can imagine. We're going to leave a legacy. We're going to make a difference. We're going to put a bell on the bike and a light on the bike, and we're still going to ride it 18 miles an hour straight into the grave. That's exactly where it's going for every single person, no matter what kind of bike they're on. That's what this part of the psalm is saying. Why do I look at the guy riding by me on that other bike and think to myself, oh, if I could just get on that bike, it'd be, and we'll just ride together at 18 miles an hour into the grave. It's where we're going. It's where everybody's going. And this is what the psalmist is saying. Can't you see that? Even in this world, why would I be afraid of those who are still riding their bike into the grave? Why would I be intimidated by that? And that's what, and it's not just intimidated. Why would I think they have the answer for me when we're going to the same hole in the ground? So that's verses 5-9. Now in verse 10, he changes the image and he gives, and this is so supportive of what he's just said. It may just be a subpoint to what he's just said. It may be a subpoint leading into what he's about to say. It's both. Obviously, it's a pivot in the psalm. It's an articulation point in the psalm. But it's with this metaphor that is so powerful. So he says in verse 10, and this is after he has just said, look, every person is going to, they can't live on forever and never see the pit. We're all going there. So in verse 10, because he sees that even the wise die. No matter how wise you are, you still die. I know how to eat. I know how to live. I know how to extend your life so that you can then go into the grave. We do all of that, and even the wise die. The fool and the stupid are just like the wise in this sense. They also perish, and they leave their wealth to others. All of us do that. Their graves are their homes forever. They're dwelling places to all generations. And this is despite the fact that they had bought up lands and had given those lands their names. I know people who have large sections of land on maps named after them. And they I think, have the right attitude about this, by the way, the family I'm thinking of. They're like, yeah, they did that a while back. I don't even know why they did that. It's not going to make any difference. That's their attitude about it. So no insult to them whatsoever. But that's the reality of it. You know, I own this land. This land is named after me. But do you know where their home is going to be forever? You know what their dwelling place is going to be to all generations? The grave. You can say, yeah, but my grave's on my land. Yeah, well, that means your land owns you, not that you own your land. And this is the point in the middle of the psalm in verse 11. Their graves are their homes forever, their dwelling places to all generations, even though they had called lands by their own names. Because, central verse 12, man in his pomp, even in his great pomp, will not remain. He's like the beasts that perish. Now remember, it's a metaphor, it's an analogy. He's like the beasts that perish. All analogies have some ways that they create similarities and some ways that they create differences. It would be absurd to read this psalm, not absurd, but wrong, to read this psalm and come to the conclusion, well, the Old Testament says people just die and they don't have a soul. You're missing the whole point of this psalm. If that's the conclusion you draw from the statement, he's like the beasts that perish. The point is that no matter how much land you claim, no matter how powerful you are in this world, you are like an animal in the sense that you're headed to the same ground that animal is headed to. He's like the beasts that perish. And it's clear, I mean, he says it in just the next couple of verses. It's clear that he wants us to see past that, but we don't. So in verse 13, he goes on, this is the path of those who have foolish confidence, yet after them, people approve of their boast. Oh, what a mighty man he was. His body is rotting in the ground. I don't mean to be too harsh about this. My dad died not too long ago. I know how painful this is when someone you love just died. This is what the psalm is getting at. That you would think that we would be clear-headed enough to see even among the powerful that when we're fawning over them, when we're saying, oh, this man who now lies in the casket at the head of the church that we're having a funeral for right now, oh, this man, he was so great. You would think in that moment that we would be having a serious comeuppance with the reality that it doesn't matter how powerful a person is inside the brackets when they get outside the brackets. It doesn't matter because we are all alike. At that moment, that's the core of this psalm. That's why he says, listen to me, all peoples, all inhabitants of the world, low and high, rich and poor together. Those are the first two verses. Why does everybody need to hear this? Because outside the brackets, you're no amount of power, no amount of learning, no amount of fame, no amount of reputation, no amount of self-confidence, none of the blustering and boasting that we've done in this, none of it gets outside the brackets. It is all gone. And you would think we'd be reminded of that, right? So in verse 12, man in his pomp will not remain. He's like the beasts that perish. And this is the path of those who have foolish confidence. And yet still after them, people approve of their boasts. Oh, he had such power. I want his power. I'm going to take over his kingdom. I'm going to be the great one to rule the land after him and then lie in the grave with him after that. We just ignore that last little part. And so in verse 14, he says, like sheep, they are appointed for Sheol. Death shall be their shepherd. And the upright, what an image, right? Death. These Psalms, they're written with the full knowledge. The sons of Korah are made the song leaders for the tabernacle by David. And then ultimately under Solomon, they're writing these Psalms. They know the 23rd Psalm. They know what David has given us. They know the Lord is our shepherd and we shall not want. I love the imagery. We are the sheep of his pasture. We love all of that imagery. This is as stark and potent a reversal of that image as the sons of Korah could possibly offer. Like sheep, they are appointed for the grave, for the place of the dead. And that's how we should hear Sheol here. It's not trying to pontificate about the metaphysics of the grave or an afterlife or whether we burn or whether we go. None of that's at issue here. It's the brackets of birth and death that are at issue here. You've got the temporal nature of the life we live in this world, and then you've got whatever goes beyond that. And we can talk of the resurrection. Obviously, I believe in the resurrection. All of that is pertinent and important, but in this psalm, we're saying if you only live within the brackets, then you haven't gained wisdom yet. And the brackets themselves should have taught you that lesson. So like sheep, they are appointed for that bracket, for Sheol, the place where the dead are. Death shall be their shepherd. So they're appointed like sheep for Sheol, and death is their shepherd. That means he's ushering them there, right? And the upright shall rule over them in the morning. Their form shall be consumed in Sheol with no place to dwell. The last line there is really harsh. I mean, it's saying not only do they go to the grave, but the visage that they wanted to preserve, you know, the image of the face on the mummy or the face that was carved into the stone so they would know what the king had looked like so that people could honor his memory. That visage underground is dissolving into the ground. It has no place to dwell. The image is gone. It's like pulling a finger out of a bucket of water. Just not there anymore. That's what he's describing. It's pretty harsh. But the image of the shepherd being death is overwhelming. If you've ever worked with kids, you've learned this. You know, in more recent years, the tendency, and I think it's a healthy tendency, is to stop beating children, stop using physical force to make children do things, which is really frustrating at times because, you know, sometimes you just want to grab them and make them do something. But you know what? What you learn over time is you're still bigger than little kids. And as a bigger thing, you can just become a wall. And when a kid wants to go left and you don't want them to go left, you just stand to their left and you just sort of stand in the way. And when kids realize you're doing this to them, they always give you the funniest look on their face. It's like, oh, what are you, why are you? But then they realize they're never going to get that way because you're just standing in the way and you just sort of usher them. You know, you sort of hold your body in a posture that's upright and spread out and your arms are out and you just sort of keep walking this direction and they want to go left, but they just keep going right. And they want to turn around, but then there's that barrier. And so they just turn back around. They just keep going right. And they just keep going in the direction that you're shepherding them. And you just sort of shepherd them in that direction. That's what death is in this world. We're constantly turning around and going, no. I'm not going to have this disease. Not me. I'm going to eat healthy. I'm going to do my exercise. I'm going to save up a bunch of money. I'm going to get the right insurance and I'm going to preserve my life. And we turn around and there's this giant shepherd of death saying, no, let's just keep going that way. And so we turn back around. We take a few more steps toward the grave. And it's like, no. I don't want to go this way. Oh, wait a minute. I can't turn around. I got to keep going. And we just, he's going to usher us right into the grave. We can want it, not want it. That's what's appointed for us. And that's where the shepherd is taking us. He's taking us to the grave. And that's the middle image. That's the central image in this psalm. And where he takes us from there is to the conclusion of the wisdom we ought to have if we were to take the brackets off of the world. The wisdom that we ought to have is like this in verses 15 through 20. And it repeats almost everything, but it doesn't convey the idea about ransoming another. It's about ransoming ourselves and looking for our help elsewhere instead. And really, at the center of everything else in this psalm is verse 15. It ends with a Selah. It's obviously something that's intended to have its own break. It concludes in a completely different kind of language, with a completely different sense. Everything that was said before it leads into the things that are said after it. So verse 15 is that verse you'll recognize sort of redeems the psalm from just being a desperate negation of the value of life in this world, right? Verse 15, but God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. And I won't take time to dwell on it now. You understand this. That's a messianic statement. That's what Jesus can say. And it's true about him, the Messiah. It's true about the messianic figures. You will not leave my soul in Sheol. You will not leave my soul in hell. You will redeem me. You will rescue me. That's what he's saying here. God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol. And because it's true about him, it's true about whoever is in him. And so Israel was able to sing this, not because they weren't going to die, not because they weren't still going to bury their loved ones. This is what Peter is saying on the day of Pentecost. We have David's grave right over there. It's not talking about him as a person. It's talking about the Messiah. And because we're in the Messiah, we also get to participate in the resurrection. So it's true about us, just like for them. So God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. So, verse 16, be not afraid when a man becomes rich, when the glory of his house increases. For when he dies, he'll carry nothing away. His glory will not go down after him. For though while he lives, he counts himself blessed, same for you. And though you get praise when you do well for yourself, that's in the psalm. I'm not adding my own apposition there. That's the psalmist. And though you get praise when you do well for yourself in exactly the same way, his soul will still go to the generation of his fathers who will never again see the light that's inside the brackets of this world. Verse 20, he repeats the message, but he adds one phrase. Man in his pomp is like the beasts that perish. The phrase that he added? Man in his pomp who is still without understanding. But remember, the opening declaration of the psalm was, my mouth shall speak wisdom, the meditation of my heart shall be understanding. Man in his pomp, yet without understanding, is like the beasts that perish. So what we get with understanding is not the wisdom to escape the brackets of this world. What we get is a recognition that we're headed 18 miles an hour straight into the grave and that we need help. And so instead of replacing fear with fawning, oh, God, you're so powerful, and we just need help, and oh, if you just put your umbrella, we replace it not with fawning, but with faith. And acknowledge this is what Jesus is teaching us, too. Don't fear those who destroy the body. They can't kill the soul. Rather, fear him who destroys both soul and body in hell. What do we bring to him? Our faith. Our faith is in our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, as James says it in James 2. So we replace, instead of fear with fawning of those who are powerful, we replace fear with faith, taking the brackets off the world. And in so doing, we gain a different shepherd, a better shepherd. The one where we can say, yeah, I know, I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. This is where I live. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil. Why? Because I have an other shepherd. I have a good shepherd. And I pray you do too.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.